Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDillan. I'm here with Tracy Mills. And we are very excited to be sitting across from Jessica Townsend.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming.
Now, can you tell people listening a little bit about your new book?
Yes, I can. So Wondersmith, The Calling of Morrigan Crow is the sequel. It's the second book in the Nevermore series. And it picks up where Morrigan is about to, she has been accepted into the Wondrous Society and she is about to start her new life and her new education with her unit, Unit 919, with eight other kids who are going to become her loyal brothers and sisters for life. And of course, being Nevermore, things go slightly awry and it's nothing like she expected it to be. And she has to sort of battle with these questions of inner good and evil. And this is the first time I've had to do my elevator pitch on this book, as you can tell.
You're doing really good.
That's very generous of you. I should probably work on it.
Well,
things happen. Things happen in this book.
Things happen in the world, which is good. I loved this book. I just read it like literally yesterday. Very, very fresh in my mind. So fun to read. I really feel like, this series is like just getting bigger and more magical with each book.
Thank you.
What was the experience of writing this one like versus the first book?
Totally different. It was a totally different experience. I mean, with the first book, I had no audience. I had no deadline. I took a really long time to write it. I wrote it quite sort of sporadically over the course of about 10 years. It was exactly what I wanted it to be. And it was very much written just for me as the audience. Wondersmith was as well, to a point, but then you also have the added sort of weight of expectation of now I have five editors and, I have
a bunch of readers
and people sort of who are expecting it. So it was really strange. Everyone told me that, second books are hard. And I kind of never really believed it until I wrote a second book. But it was the writing of it itself. The thing that really struck me is that I felt like, because I have quite a good roadmap for this series and I knew a lot of what was going to happen in this book, but then putting it down on the page and committing to it, it was making decisions. Because, ideas are a dime a dozen. I have a million ideas. It's just how to execute them and which ones to use and how to use them. So it was the nailing down of, this is how the Wondrous Society works. This is who this character is. This is what happens here. And committing to those decisions when, it felt like you're plucking butterflies out of the air and nailing them to a corkboard. Like that's
great analogy. Right?
So it's like, okay, now this is set now and I can't change it. And this is going to kind of set a path for the rest of the books. So it was sort of a frightening feeling, but also, kind of good, kind of empowering. Cause now I'm like, all right, well, I can't go back now. I just, this is how this particular thing works.
I do love that that's your problem though. Like I've got a million ideas. Having ideas isn't hard. Just...
how was it sitting down after the amazing reception for Nevermore? Was it more intimidating sitting down this time to write it?
I mean, it's definitely in the back of your mind that, just that people are going to read this and people are going to have a certain expectation of where their characters are going and what's going to happen. And even just people saying my favorite character is, Fenn or Hawthorne or whatever. I hope that they have more in the plot. So, there was a point in the writing where I was like, I don't have enough Fenestra in here because in this book, she's not completely crucial to the plot.
Yeah.
And so as I was going through and writing, she didn't really show up in the first write through. So I had to really add her in because even my editors were like, excuse me,
we love Fenn. Where is Fenn?
Yeah.
I wanted a mini cat.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
I mean, I'm allergic to cats, but I'm assuming that doesn't carry over to Magnificat. They'd be different.
No,
right?
Totally different kind of fur, so it's fine.
Good to know. there's so much to talk about in this book. I loved this is a non-spoilery thing to say, I believe. But if you don't want me to say it, we'll just edit it out. Yeah.
I'm okay with spoilers, it's fine.
I liked meeting the Swift family. I thought that was really great. I thought they were so charming. I just want to be adopted by them. Like, no offense to my family. I still keep in touch with them. But,
I'll find out.
I really, really liked that. Was that fun to write?
I'm really happy to hear you say that, because I love the Swift family. and they were in the first book. That was that whole thing with them going. Really? Yeah, they were originally part of the scene where, they were taken out. I had to take them out for space because the book was way too long. But they were in the chapter in Nevermore where Morrigan and Hawthorne are going to the Black Parade, and I had to change it and have Fenestra take them to the Black Parade. But I really wanted, there was no reason for them to be in this book either, but I know so much about them and I know that they will be necessary down the line. So I was like, no, I have to put them in this book. And I love them. I loved writing that whole dynamic. And, you know, I wrote that scene with them ages ago, like years ago. And originally, I've really kind of had to challenge my own sort of, I think we all have like gender biases, and you know, I kind of had to challenge that in myself, because the way that I had originally written them, the roles were reversed. So, you know, Dave was kind of the more loosey-goosey, outlandish, crazy one, and Kat was, you know, the sort of eye-rolly, sensible, overcautious one. And I was like, oh no, that's literally every book where there are parents, is, you know, the dad gets to be the cool one and the mom is the overcautious one. And I, you know, a good couple of years ago, I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm reversing it. And, you know, Kat, Hawthorne's mother, became this sort of grown-up female version of Hawthorne, and Dave was sort of the worrywart.
Really loved it. And I must say, I've been curious to meet Hawthorne's mom ever since in the first book, the crazy jumper thing.
Yes.
I was like, she's going to be cool.
Yeah.
I feel like she's going to be cool. And she was.
She's one of my favourite characters. I love her. I can't wait to write more of her.
Oh, I'm excited to hear that they'll be featuring more in future books. Any little tidbit we can get about future books.
Are we going to get more dragons?
As much as you want. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There'll be more dragons.
Yeah, me too. And the Magnificat.
More of both, definitely.
Another thing I thought is really good about this, because in the first book you've got Cadence, as she didn't really, she was in the book, but she wasn't in the book as much as she is in this one, and I'm intrigued by her as a character. She must be fun to write.
She is. She's one of my favourite characters. I always say I have kind of three favourite characters, and it's Morrigan, Fenestra, and Cadence. And she's my favourite because I know so much about her. I know so much about her backstory and so much more about, you know, what is to come with her. In the first book, she really is, you know, that there's, you have kind of the red herring of Noelle. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't read Nevermore, but you have kind of the red herring that, you know, you think that Noelle is going to be the villain and Noelle is the problem and Noelle is the one who is sort of thwarting Morrigan's plans. And I quite deliberately wrote her as this very kind of standard mean schoolgirl bully thing.
The Regina George.
The Regina George. So that I could sort of, you know, subvert that by having Cadence come up and take you by surprise, and actually, you know, she's the one who's thwarting all these plans. But I love Cadence because she's so grey as a character. Like, I didn't, she, you know, in this book they become friends, and you kind of see that slowly play out across this book, and she was always intended to be this friend. But I mean, I wouldn't call her like a frenemy, but there is a tension. There's like a friction with her and Morrigan, and Morrigan's never quite sure, like, is this person on my side or not? And those are the characters that I love. I love when there's a lot of grey in a character and you never know quite which way they're going to go.
I find her very fascinating, and she sort of gets my heart a little bit, like the idea that no one ever remembers her. Like,
It's kind of sad. I know, I feel bad for her. No wonder she's so rude.
And of course, we've got more of all the characters that we've come to know and love in Nevermore. More Jupiter. Do you really like how? Because almost every word out of Jupiter's mouth is charming and hilarious. Like, is that just your own? I mean, you can't answer this question. Yes, that's just my own charm.
It's just that I'm charming and hilarious. I can't help it.
But is that hard to summon that, or is it just flow naturally?
I don't know. It just, Jupiter is one of the characters who comes out really easily on the page for me. I think he's the kind of person that I wish I could be, is, you know, someone who just strides into a room and owns the place. I think everyone kind of secretly wishes they could be a bit Jupiter. But I love him as a character because he's got such a big heart, and he is, you know, this sort of archetype of the eccentric mentor, but also he's not great as a person. Like, he's not an amazing role model. He's, you know, he's quite neglectful at times. And he's sort of, and that's not through any kind of, you know, in a villainy or anything. It's purely just because he's not a parent. Like, he's not actually Morrigan's parent. He's filling the parent role. Right. He doesn't get kids. Like, he doesn't understand that you can't just, like, vaguely explain things and then rush off into the sunset. Like, so that's what kind of makes him fun and also like a useful character in the plot, because I think you need that sort of scatterbrained you know, adult who gives partial information at best.
It's been funny between the two of us, because I find Jupiter is like a Willy Wonka style character.
Yeah.
Whereas... I'm like, he's the 11th Doctor for me.
Oh, that's interesting, because people always say that he's Doctor Who, and they're like, oh, he was David Tennant. I'm like, I think he's probably a bit more Matt Smith than David Tennant.
He was an auburn head Matt Smith for me, and I love every second of it.
Fabulous. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of those influences. Definitely there's a bit of like Willy Wonka and a bit of Doctor, and there's a bit of, I think there's even like a bit of my eldest brother in him, like, you know, the like some of the things that he says occasionally, like the Nunya, when he says Nunya business, that's something my brother used to say all the time. So
he's great. He's like, I love that archetype of character, that zany, like crazy, oddball, powerful dude, like kind of like Hal from Hal's Moving Castle.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Love it. It's a delight to read.
Yeah, fun and useful.
So I know you can't tell us much about what's to come, but, you know, are you allowed to say, sort of roughly speaking, how many books you think there'll be, or what can we know about the future?
Well, I've planned it as a 9-book series, yes. And I've always sort of in the past year, anytime I've said that, I've, you know, prefaced it with, but, you know, we'll see, like, I'm signed on for 3, like, they have to do really well, but... You know, just kind of recently I'm starting to let myself realize that, oh no, actually it kind of looks like we might be able to do all 9, which is shocking to me. But, but it's looking positive.
Hearing you say they have to do really well, I'm like, we've observed this. This has happened.
And if it's me, I'm just like, oh, I don't know. It was like...
I don't know how much better they could go.
Like, considering, like, I was reading it at a cafe the weekend, and I'm getting mobbed by 9-year-olds who just wanted it because it's not out yet. And, like, I don't think I have any problems or worries about children picking this up.
I never really, like, kind of let myself think or, like, kind of... I don't know. I'm so wary of that. I'm just like, oh, I don't know.
It's a
maybe
huge
we'll
amount
see.
Of success. But it must be really strange.
It is really strange. The whole thing's like really bizarre. And I feel like I have this, you know, sort of kind of, I don't even know how to say it. Like it's this dichotomy of my life where half the time I'm doing things like this, I'm recording a podcast or I'm, you know, signing books or
winning
getting photos.
Million awards.
Yeah. Stuff like that, yeah. And then, you know, the rest of the time I'm like hunched over my laptop, like just like living on blue light and Red Bull, like, just trying to write and just, why am I doing this?
I like so, this insight into your writing
process. Yeah, it's really important. I mean, the hunching is really important to, you know, pay my chiropractor bills. He's gonna get a car.
So do you have, when you are writing, do you have times in the day that you prefer to write? Or let's just talk a bit about your magical process.
Well, magical. That was very generous. So it's been a bit of a weird one with book two because, you know, in the writing of book one, it was my extracurricular. It was like the thing that I was working full time. I wrote in the mornings, I wrote in the evenings, I wrote on the weekends, and everything was kind of around my normal life. And now it's my full-time job, but it hasn't stopped being my hobby either. So it's kind of genuinely been a 24/7 thing. And I've really struggled on a personal level with like building boundaries into my life of, okay, so now I have to be a proper responsible grown-up and have some kind of schedule that I follow. And no, I have not done that. I've written long into the night and I've pulled a million all-nighters. So it's been a really weird one. But I think that I naturally write best in the afternoons and evenings, but I really am desperate to become a morning person who like gets up at the crack of dawn and has all of their writing done before 9 a.m. I still am so optimistic as a person. I have this like ridiculous unfounded optimism that one day I'm going to become a morning person. Hasn't happened yet.
Look, it's never happened for me either. I think it's, if you have to force it, it's not.
Yeah, right.
It's not gonna
I'm 33. It would have happened by now.
mean, this, like, Nevermore has been so well received, not just here in Australia, but globally. I mean, what's that like when you go to other countries and you've, you know, you're a bestseller in the UK and you're winning awards in the UK as well as...
Are you based in the UK?
I'm sort of half and half. So I live kind of half on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland and then half, like not strictly half and half. I sort of just come back and forth. I spent the first half of this year living in London and I'll go back at some point next year for, you know, a few months or 6 months or something. It's strange because I feel like the UK is also my home. I've kind of lived there on and off in the last 10 years. So it is really nice to have the audience in both places. And then when I go to the States, it's just, I don't know, it's just weird being in the States. I just like, it's weird that I've been there at all to me. But it's been amazing. People are lovely. And I mean, it's book people, right? I feel like it's all just one group of people. It's all just people who read and people who love books who are naturally like nice, friendly, generous, kind
the best people.
The genuinely the best people. I know, like, it sounds like I'm just saying that because you're Booktopia and, you know, but no, genuinely, like, everywhere you go, readers are good.
Yeah, you've always got something to talk about if you're
100% never starved for conversation.
And now, so film rights are sold.
Yes.
And I don't know how far along the process that is, but I just want to know, as the creator of these characters, when you know that it's possible that you're going to see them on film, what is that like? Do you worry that it's not going to match up? Or
It's such a strange thing. So I was really... And this is probably going to sound a bit disingenuous, but I was so reluctant to even think about anything like that in the beginning because that all happened around the same time that the book deal happened. So it was Frankfurt Book Fair. There was, a bunch of international rights being sold while there was an auction with the 8 publishers. And then around that same time, my agent, she was like, okay, well, we've sent this off to our film agent that we work with and she's going to, you know, shop it around. And I, in my head, I just went, nothing's going to happen with that. And I really believed, I was like, maybe 10 years down the track, if the book does well, like something like that will happen. But they came back really quickly and said there was interest from Fox and there was another one and there was going to be an auction for the film rights. And I felt so like stomach churningly nervous about it that I just didn't even want to think about it. And I was so... I don't know. I think that my agent was a little bit like, what's wrong? Because I was like, okay. Anyway, let's talk about something else. How are you? Like changing the subject. Cause it's that thing of like suddenly this thing that's been in my head for 10 years and has been, and I'm so private about my writing. Like the only person who had read any of this book really was my sister in that period. And suddenly it was outside of me and I was watching it walk around and be in other people's eyeballs. Like, and then suddenly there was like film talk and I was like, no. Like, I'm such a control freak. I was like, no, I wanted to snatch it back. But when I spoke to the EP at Fox, she was so great. And she really, like, the conversation that we had, I felt so comfortable instantly because the things that she pulled out, the threads, like the thematic threads that she pulled out were so important to me. And she even said things that other publishers and other, you know, other people who had read it hadn't really noticed before. And she's like, oh, I see that, you know, you were trying to do this. And I was like, I was. So and she was really got it. And then, you know, a few months later, Drew Goddard came on board to write and produce, and he is part of the whole thing now. He's hopefully, I don't know when, like in the next few years or so, but he and I had a conversation really early on. We spoke on the phone for about an hour and I just felt like I instantly trusted him, instantly felt comfortable with him, felt like we had very similar aesthetics. You know, I didn't know who he was when he first came on, because that's nothing against him. I don't know anything about anyone. I don't know who anyone is. Barely know who I am. But
Jessica,
thank you. All right, not on my hand. I'm gonna need that in the next 2 weeks. But he, you know, we have a very similar aesthetic. He was he wrote for Buffy. That was one of his first writing jobs. Yeah. And his first ever episode that he wrote was called Selfless. And as soon as I realized that, I instantly had that episode in my head because I'm a huge Buffy fan. And I realized it was one of my favorite episodes ever because it's so dark and it's got these very sinister storyline, and then it also cuts between that and this hilarious subplot.
Yeah.
And it was just that, you know, that kind of, I hate using the word juxtaposition, but that juxtaposition of, I know, what's wrong with me? I hate myself. Why am I saying these words? it was that, like, those two things right alongside each other, this very sinister story and this very silly story, and it just works so well. And I feel like that's what I love in books, and that's what I love to write. And we've kind of, you know, bonded over that. And I was in LA last year and we had dinner and it's all very positive. And I feel like I've ranted on quite long enough about Drew Goddard, but I just, at the point is that I feel very comfortable.
I'm excited that he's doing it. Yeah.
Yeah,
all I needed to hear was Buffy. And
right.
It'll be great. It'll be great. I can't wait. We're out of time.
Sorry, it was because I ranted on for so long and kept using $10 words. I'm sorry.
That is what we want in the podcast. We want talking. Thank you so much for giving us that.
Anytime.
But really, thank you for coming in. We know how busy you are. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you about your amazing series.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a year since you were here.
It doesn't at all. It feels like we just did this 2 weeks ago. I'll come back tomorrow. See you then.
Okay. It's a plan. And podcast listeners, you can get Jessica Townsend's books at Booktopia.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.